Welcome to Agency in Focus, Department of Homeland Security, sponsored by Leidos. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The U.S. Coast Guard helps protect the country's interests far beyond its own coast. In fact, it has ships operating throughout the world. One reason is its illegal drug trafficking interdiction mission, a mission that's growing and taking up more resources. In part one of my interview, Admiral Paul Zukunft, the Coast Guard Commandant, explains the international part of his job.
One of my collateral duties as the Commandant of the Coast Guard is I chair the Interdiction Committee, which is made up of principals from across the entire interagency, which is really designed of how do we synchronize whole of government within the United States to have the maximum effect against transnational criminal organizations, and in this case, those that are trafficking in illicit drugs. Well, it doesn't take a genius to realize that the United States can't do it alone, that we've got to bring on other partners, other allies. And so we went down to Ecuador because we have a new president down there, and President Moreno, and he has opened the door to the United States. What's caused the door to open is that Ecuador is now seeing a significant increase in cocaine consumption and with it violent crime, especially near the border between Ecuador and Colombia. So they have a problem. We then went to Colombia and we met with Vice President Naranjo, who's leading a interagency and joint task force to eradicate and try to stop the production of coca and ultimately producing cocaine in Colombia, but they have enormous challenges in front of them as well. Resource challenges and sometimes resources, law enforcement and challenging, especially when drugs enter the high seas, their limited ability to apprehend those. And then we met with President Varela in Panama. And President Varela views himself as somewhat of a firewall between South America and the United States. Last year, they apprehended record numbers of illegal migrants. Some of these, what we would call a special interest alien, trying to get to the United States, and yet they're stopping them in Panama. And then they're sending them back the other way. They're doing the same thing with drugs arriving in Panama, and they realize that most of these drugs are destined for transit through Central America, spawns violent crime, but ultimately for consumption here in the United States.
All right, so what's the conclusion of all of this? I mean, where do we go from here?
So now it's time to really roll up our sleeves. So Ecuador said we want to do more combined operations with the United States. And when they say the United States at sea, what they mean is the United States Coast Guard. Colombia, meeting with the head of Colombian Navy, said we want to do even more work with the United States and in Panama. We've done combined operations with all of these countries in the past. I'm optimistic of our relationship with Ecuador, and that's a key one. With the prior regime, we were basically shut down in 2010. That was probably one of our most effective bases in detecting drugs at sea.
Now, does Ecuador have a Navy and separate Coast Guard like the United States, or do they just have one waterborne service?
They have a Navy and they have a Coast Guard as well. Obviously, not to the magnitude of our Navy or our Coast Guard here in the United States.
And how did you find their training, their level of equipment readiness and modernization relative to what the Coast Guard has?
Well, we didn't get out to the field units, Tom. But that was one of the topics of discussion. They said, we would love to see the Coast Guard back. We would love to do training with the Coast Guard again. And so it's good to refresh that dialogue.
Because that must be pretty much of a stretch in terms of resources to train down there for the Coast Guard to project that far forward, I would imagine is kind of a stretch for you.
Well, believe it or not, it's not. Most people think Coast Guard, and on any given day, we are off the coast of all seven continents around the world. In that part of the world, between Colombia, Panama, and Ecuador, on any given day, we have six major Coast Guard ships. And many times, they'll call in these ports to refuel, to reprovision, and we can certainly do training when we're in those ports as well, because we're already off their coast.
We're speaking with Admiral Paul Zukunft, the Commandant of the Coast Guard, and this increase in interdiction emphasis, what has that meant for the staffing of the Coast Guard? You're not growing really right now.
Yeah. So when I came into this job a little over 3 years ago, Tom, the first thing I said, we're going to have intel drive where we operate. Now, intel also drives where we're not operating. You don't have infinite resources, you're constrained, but we have information and we're staffed, we're members of the national intelligence community to have awareness of over 80% of the maritime drug flow that are on the waters in the Pacific and in the Caribbean. But back in 2014, on the best of days, we could maybe target 10% of that 80%. So it really just came down to where do you reprioritize your missions? And so we pulled from other mission areas and we applied more resources to address this threat. So last year, record removal of cocaine. This year, we're on pace to beat last year's record.
And so where have you pulled from?
Well, I probably don't want to say that, but you know, I just call it, you know, good operational risk management. But I probably don't want to divulge that. But the fact that people don't realize that I pulled from an area tells me that, you know, we made the right decision in terms of how do we effectively manage risk.
And how do you manage the relationship with, say, Customs and Border Protection and ICE and some of the other Homeland Security units that are really sisters to you within DHS? That also are involved, because they send out a lot of press releases on drug interdiction.
Well, we could not have the success we had without our teammates in HSI or ICE and with CBP. And, you know, I don't want to leave DEA out of the picture as well. Huge team effort in terms of sharing information. Customs and Border Protection fly aircraft out of the same base that we fly out of down in El Salvador. Huge enablers in terms of detecting this flow. It's our ships that have the authorities to apprehend and interdict the vessels, but it really is a collective effort among everybody, but certainly great synergy within the Department of Homeland Security.
Now, has the shift in priorities or shift in where you operate also increased the tempo at which you're operating ships and other craft?
I wouldn't say it's increased. We're deployed just as many days as we have been in the past, but those days are much more action-packed than they have been in the past. I've spent many years at sea, and I would much rather be running at a fast pace, knowing that you are in the game. And again, because the information is so good, in years past, I would liken it to a tractor. You know, digging furrows back and forth, and then hopefully, you know, you stumble upon something on one of those passes. And that's kind of how we did this mission, you know, 12, 13 years ago. Well, now we know where the threat's at, and you are running at full speed to interdict it. We've taken most of the guesswork out of it. And so, you know, to be deployed, when you talk to these crews coming back, I mean, some of them, they're counting down the days till they can get back there and go again. I would like them going fishing, and it's a feeding frenzy, and you have to come in and you've got to fillet your fish, sell them. You can't wait to go back and catch some more. So this is kind of how our crews are operating today.
But does that take a toll on the readiness or the ability to maintain the equipment? I mean, does it accelerate the aging of what's already an aged fleet? And also, does it affect the ability to, do you have enough people to rotate in and out of these high-tempo operations?
Yeah. Well, Tom, our biggest challenge is I've got 50-year-old ships down there doing this mission right now. And the only way they're able to do it are the men and women who literally for generations have been maintaining these older ships. But we run into parts obsolescence. So if a system breaks, sometimes the part just isn't there. And so that takes them out of the mission. Our newer ships that are coming in, our national security cutters, our fast response cutters, we'll soon deliver our offshore patrol cutter. We'll take delivery of the first one in 2021. These are truly a quantum leap above their predecessors in terms of the capability that they bring.
And with respect to training, has the new emphasis, the new mission, or the emphasis on the mission that you've shifted to, has that affected how people are trained and how they're recruited even?
We haven't really changed our recruiting approach. And by that I mean, you know, we don't take anyone who has a GED. You know, you better at a minimum have a high school diploma. Now, we've taken a few with GEDs because those folks had Bachelor of Science degrees. They went on and went to college. The quality and caliber of people entering the Coast Guard today in an all-volunteer service is at an all-time high. But they come into the service because they want to be involved. They want to contribute. And so this is an area where they can contribute. We continually update our training. And probably the most important one is our use of force training, especially when you look at the scrutiny applied to law enforcement in general. to make sure that we always use the minimal force necessary to compel compliance. It really goes back to Alexander Hamilton, the father of the Coast Guard. And he said, be mindful that we are a nation of free men and are intolerant of rude and haughty behavior. So we want to make sure that we are not rude and haughty in the conduct of carrying out our missions.
Admiral Paul Zukunft is Commandant of the Coast Guard. In more of the interview, he'll discuss progress on building new ships to replace the aging fleet, and you can find the whole interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin. It wasn't that long ago that brand new Coast Guard cutters required towing back to port after their engines quit. After a series of critical GAO reports, Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Paul Zukunft says those development problems are mostly solved. We met with the Commandant at Coast Guard headquarters. Next on deck, so to speak, is a badly needed fleet of icebreakers.
We do have the product right. We have not had to tow any ship back when it was on patrol. The engines that we operate, it's called an MTU, but it's designed to operate at a high RPM. They don't do well idling. So it was a bit of a human learning curve for us. The older diesel plants that we had, you can run on one engine, run it at an idle speed, and you can run it indefinitely. With these, they bog down. You need to keep a load on it. We also found out that the most efficient speed for these ships to transit at is much faster than the older ships. So they're saving fuel, yet they get to the theater of operations much quicker. So part of it was on us. It was a learning curve. The davit systems, that was an easy fix. And so we're at the point now where a national security cutter on its maiden voyage literally pays for itself, if you will, and then usually 1.5 times over in the value of illicit drugs that it removes in one deployment. And these ships will be around for 30 plus years. The technology that goes into these ships, our ability to exploit and initiate intelligence on, you know, transnational criminal organizations is a huge game changer for us as well. And that's why you see these ships come back to San Diego or Cape Canaveral with an entire flight deck with pallet after pallet of cocaine just from one deployment. So they really have been a game changer. But we've been through this learning curve. And I could not be more pleased with the performance of these platforms.
And there must be an operational savings, drug interdiction aside. They use less fuel, they go faster, and they require less life cycle cost, at least at this point in their life cycle.
Correct? And that is correct, Tom, and we need to stay in front of that, which is why when I testify on the Hill, I talk about, you know, I need 5% growth in my operating base, because for 5 years running now, we find ourselves in our fifth consecutive year funded below the Budget Control Act. I'm a military service. And if you were to tell any one of my other service chief counterparts that you were going to be funded for the next 5 years below the Budget Control Act, yet you still have a job to do, some of that work would have to stop. And so the area where we start incurring some degree of risk is on the maintenance side. And once you go down that slippery slope, you may have to lay up or take a ship out of service. So it's a very delicate balance. But as a military service, we need to be funded like a military service. And so we do need that growth put back into our budget to at least keep pace with inflation, if nothing else.
We're speaking with Coast Guard Commandant Paul Zukunft. And let's talk about some other types of vessels besides the national security cutters. You mentioned fast response cutter. What is the status of that program?
We just awarded phase two a little over a year ago to build out all 58 of these. The last five ships that came off the production line were delivered with zero discrepancies, which is a real testimony to the shipbuilder, Bollinger Shipyards, and then all the systems that go in them, L3 Communications and others. But these are, again, quantum leaps above a 110-foot patrol boat that they replace. The weapon systems, the command and control systems that are on there, its seacaping capability, its speed, all of the above, tremendous, tremendous platforms.
And there was a third type of ship you mentioned.
So we awarded the offshore patrol cutter, which will be a light frigate, about 350 feet in length. And so Eastern Shipbuilding Group is the contractor to build the first nine of these. It's a program of 25 ships. And quite honestly, we cannot get these ships in the water soon enough. We will take delivery of the first one in 2021.
And let's talk about things that fly, because you're exploring the area of unmanned aircraft.
Now, we are long overdue to get into the world of land-based, long-range, unmanned aerial platforms to operate in the maritime domain. We're doing that right now with ship-based systems that are quite stealthy, and they've been very effective, because in the past, you would see a big white ship and an orange helicopter arrive over the horizon. And maybe you have a ship that's waiting to refuel a go-fast. And we've had this exact scenario play out. And so one of these ships launched its unmanned aerial system. And they realized this is a refueling vessel. And so for 36 hours, they monitored this. And then once the go-fast showed up, they pulled back the unmanned system, launched the manned helicopter with an M240 machine gun with a 50 caliber sniper in the cockpit of this aircraft, and then disabled the go-fast. But they never knew we were there. And so, you know, several tons of cocaine removed just using more stealthy technology.
So the platforms exist that you could adapt for Coast Guard use. You just have to get the budget and the operational concept to use them.
Yeah, and so we've seen, you know, a mark in this year's budget to start moving out in that direction, and we'll work within the Department of Homeland Security, look at what's already, you know, commercially available off the shelf. And it really comes down to what's the right sensor package that can operate in a maritime environment to expand our range. And this would not be based in the United States. We would push it downrange into the transit zone. When people think about protecting our borders, our borders really begin 1,500 miles and more beyond the United States. But all of this flow is destined here for, you know, when we talk about drugs, you know, they want to get it here. But it doesn't arrive on our shoreline. It lands in Central America, but we need to stop it well south before it arrives here in the United States.
And anything else on the platform front we should know about?
Well, the big one's the icebreaker fleet.
The United States has one.
So we have one heavy icebreaker, one medium icebreaker, and that's it. We see the Arctic opening up to more and more human activity. About half of the world's reserves that are in the Arctic are actually in U.S. EEZ and are in our extended continental shelf. So we have sovereign interests up there as well. Russia will be arming ships, icebreakers, and they'll be deploying up in the high latitudes in the next several years. And right now we're not doing anything about it, at least not on the surface. And so we do have a mark this year. We've got five shipyards right now that are competing to build a fleet of icebreakers for the United States. National assets in the true sense. When you only have one heavy icebreaker, you have no self-rescue capability whatsoever. If I was the CNO of the Navy and said, you've got one aircraft carrier, don't break it, it's not enough. And so our program is to build out six icebreakers.
So despite what we hear about the Arctic melting, there's still plenty of ice to be broken through up there.
Well, I've been up there quite a bit, Tom. And
it's still cold?
Yeah, it's very cold. The wind shifts, and now you're beset in ice. Russia has laid claim to most of the Arctic Ocean, all the way up to the North Pole. What's our ability to challenge that? You really can't put the challenge flag down with a submarine. And we can certainly operate, our Navy can, but how do you operate surface to surface? And so these are really strategic assets in terms of our national security objectives in the Arctic. And it's good to see us, we're finally moving, getting our foot off the shore, if you will, and moving up into that area in a meaningful way by recapitalizing our icebreaking fleet.
Admiral Paul Zukunft is Commandant of the Coast Guard. I'm Tom Temin.
For 15 years, Leidos has seen firsthand the Department of Homeland Security's men and women safeguard the American people, our homeland, and our values. In support of the DHS mission, our technical experts have delivered trusted solutions in mission-based IT, cybersecurity, biometrics, and logistics. Ranked number one on Washington Technology's top 100, Leidos has the experience DHS can count on, and we're ready for your future missions. Learn more at Leidos.com/homeland.
We're speaking with Admiral Paul Zukunft, the Commandant of the Coast Guard. And I want to get back to the human capital side of the Coast Guard. You mentioned the quality of person you're seeking these days. How does recruiting generally hold up? I mean, for the rest of the armed forces, they barely make it, but they make it. How about the Coast Guard?
Yeah, we're hitting our targets, Tom. Delighted to see that. And what allows us to sustain the effort we are right now, we of all the armed services, we enjoy the highest retention rate. 40% of the recruits that will come out of Cape May, New Jersey, will be on active duty 20 years from now. 60% of the officers that we commission up in New London, Connecticut, 60% will be on active duty 20 years from now. So it's one thing if you recruit, we make tremendous investments in training these individuals, but if they then leave and walk out the door, we never get to that next level where they truly become professionals at what they do, and we continue to operate with journeymen. So as long as we continue to enjoy these high retention rates, we will be well served. But I cannot assume that we're going to enjoy these unprecedented retention rates. If the economy changes, do people decide, hey, it's time for me to leave? Or Coast Guard, thank you for these great job skills. I'm not going to go make more money somewhere else. So we actually put out a human capital strategy for the 21st century to address things like dual careers and child care and the number of times we move incentive packages. And now on top of all of that, we're folding in a new retirement system, as are all the armed services. And how do we accommodate that as well? But if you don't look out for your people, you can build all these great new ships and new planes, but if you're not keeping an eye on your people, they will be tied to the pier and we will not be able to put to sea.
Yes, because the Air Force, I think, is the most visible example of what happens when you have trouble with retention, because there's an airline industry that's hungry for people, and it's pretty easy to jump ship, to make a bad metaphor here. But Coast Guard, it seems like there's more you can do by staying in the Coast Guard.
There is, and when I go out and visit field units and when I see our enlisted members in formation, the first thing I look for are their good conduct ribbons, not to see who's been naughty or nice, but each service has a distinct color code for its good conduct ribbon, and I see a lot of Navy, I see Army. I don't see too many, I'd see a few Air Force, but predominantly I see Navy, Marine, and Army good conduct ribbons in the ranks, prior service, and so they're taking sometimes 6-7 years of experience from their service, and they're jumping ship to join the Coast Guard. That's not a bad thing for me. And it's a different environment for them, but that's been an opportunity for others that still want to serve, but maybe they want to serve in a different capacity, you know, at sea in the United States Coast Guard.
That's the Coast Guard Commandant, Admiral Paul Zukunft, that interview taking place at Coast Guard headquarters. There's more to this interview, and you can hear the whole thing at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Agency in Focus, Department of Homeland Security, sponsored by Leidos on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. The entire program can be found on demand at federalnewsradio.com, search DHS 15.